Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Here are two snapshots of American power projected across the world. An image of nearly limitless accomplishment.
I can report to the American people and to the world that the United States has conducted an operation that killed Osama bin Laden, the leader of Al-Qaeda.
Power, success, technology, remote control victory. Now an image of fiasco exactly 20 years ago.
My message to you is your country is grateful, and so is the rest of the world, and so are the vast majority of the Somali people. Our mission from this day forward is to increase our strength, do our job, bring our soldiers out, and bring them home.
That's President Clinton announcing the withdrawal from Somalia after the deadly ambush of American Army Rangers and Marines that became known as Black Hawk Down. When the U.S. projects its military power today, there is a complicated series of competing images that accompanies the warnings, accusations, and speeches.
Spitfires rose from British bases and fought for the domination of the air over the desolate beach, while ground forces continued a stubborn rearguard action.
At the end of World War II, America's unchallenged superiority was an abstract but undeniable threat to everyone. It was not abstract to the Japanese, who had seen what nuclear weapons could do. Vietnam and Korea, though, raised serious questions about what could be accomplished on the battlefield in the Cold War, and the tens of thousands of American soldiers who could be lost there. Attacks against Marines in Lebanon in the 1980s showed the limits of U.S. peacekeeping between two antagonists like the Israelis and the Palestinians. But some lessons seem to have been learned by 1991.
5 months ago, Saddam Hussein started this cruel war against Kuwait. Tonight, the battle has been joined. This military action, taken in accord with United Nations resolutions and with the consent of the United States Congress, follows months of constant and virtually endless diplomatic activity on the part of the United Nations, the United States, and many, many other countries.
An overwhelming force, an overwhelming consensus, led by George H.W. Bush, Iraq was removed from Kuwait, Vietnam was removed from national memory.
Oh my God.
That looks like a second plane. We just saw another plane coming in from the side.
But the 9/11 attacks created something not seen since World War II, a collective Pearl Harbor-like spirit of national mourning and outrage, channeled into the invasion first of Afghanistan and then the case for going after Iraq once and for all, a case regrettably made by Secretary of State Colin Powell.
One of the most worrisome things that emerges from the thick intelligence file we have on Iraq's biological weapons is the existence of mobile production facilities used to make biological agents. Let me take you inside that intelligence file and share with you what we know from eyewitness accounts.
Brought to you courtesy of the red, white, and blue.
All the decades of deceit and cruelty have now reached an end. Saddam Hussein and his sons must leave Iraq within 48 hours.
It was shock and awe in Iraq, certainty and arrogance, soldiers alongside media embeds, missions accomplished, and then the whole business unraveled.
Back in the days of shock and awe, we came to liberate them all.
Today, the images of Iraq quagmire and Abbottabad quick raid strike are two sides of the same U.S. military coin. And today, with the options being debated over Syria, there is no shock. No awe.
If, in fact, we make a choice to have repercussions for the use of chemical weapons.
As a father, I can't get the image out of my head.
Then the Assad regime, which is involved in a civil war, trying to protect itself.
Of a man who held up his dead child, wailing while chaos swirled around him.
Will have received a pretty strong signal that, in fact, it better not do it again.
Human suffering that we can never ignore or forget.
There is considerable fatigue about the unpredictability of all this. Memories of Black Hawks Down, losses of ambassadors in Benghazi, and questions after 2003 that hardly need to be asked about U.S. credibility over any case it makes regarding the use of weapons of mass destruction. In a few minutes, Bill Keller, former executive editor of the New York Times, joins us to discuss the contemplated military intervention in Syria and where it fits into our complicated history. And we've been hearing your thoughts. Should the United States use military power in Syria?
My name is Kim. I'm calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. And it is time for somebody to stand up and take a stance against using this type of weapon against their own people. We stood by and watched this happen time and time and time again. Somebody has to stand up.
Lonnie Higgins from Hawaii. My take is no military involvement led by any other nations other than the Arab League. The presence of chemical weapons is an issue for that region to contain and take leadership in.
Love to know what you think. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. So America's reputation as a nuclear superpower, its military experiences in Vietnam, Panama, Somalia, Beirut, Iraq, and Afghanistan all inform a world trying to evaluate what may happen now that the U.S. is contemplating some retaliatory strike against Syria in the Middle East. Joining us now is Bill Keller, former executive editor of the New York Times, current op-ed columnist for the paper. Bill Keller, welcome back.
Hi, John.
So what do you think of a little bit of the history that I recounted there and some you may add? What do you think casts the longest shadow on this decision whether to retaliate in Syria? And from the Syrian perspective, what might they be most concerned with or think is the highest probability of an outcome?
Well, I was thinking as I was listening to your wind up that they say that generals are always fighting the last war, and it's kind of true of countries too, fighting or not fighting, but we're sort of enthralled to the last experience, especially if it was a very profound or traumatic one. And the thing that casts a shadow over the question of Syria is Iraq. Another autocrat who represents a sectarian minority. You have another kind of dubious collection of opposition factions competing for foreign help, patronage. You have some of the same voices, John McCain, for instance, exhorting us to intervene. You have the familiar fears of a quagmire. You even have the sort of murky intelligence about WMD again. And so I think to a lot of people, this feels like, oh my God, here we go again. And I think it feels that way to the president and the administration. There is a real sense of, we're not going to be fooled again.
Although there's a really curious irony here in the sense, and some of your commentators at the New York Times have suggested this as well, that Syria has managed to become Iraq circa 2006 without any real help from the United States or an invasion. It's managed to do this on its own.
Yeah, you mean hurtling downhill towards a failed state.
Yeah,
that is true. I've written on a couple of occasions that I think this clouds our judgment of Syria in a bad way. It's important to focus on the things about Syria that are not like Iraq. First and foremost, in Iraq, the whole argument of an American national interest was largely fabricated and based on bogus intelligence. In Syria, we have a real national interest. You can argue about what you should do about it, but it's not Iraq in that respect. A failed Syria would become a haven for terrorists, and now with access to chemical weapons, which they have in abundance in Syria, be a danger to surrounding countries, which are all American allies. It would be threatened to prompt a regional Sunni-Shiite sectarian war, which kind of seems to be more likely by the day. It would embolden Iran and Hezbollah, which are both supporting the Assad regime. And it sends a message to a lot of places, notably Iran, that our threats are hollow.
Well, then how tragic is it, and maybe I'm preempting your answer here, that if this is the conflict where we really do have a national interest, did we, in a sense, squander our national will, our fiscal sort of ability to pay for such a conflict and even the military's capacity to support an on-the-ground conflict like this in Iraq. We squandered it in Iraq and do not have the capacity, really, to accomplish anything significant in Syria.
I think that's right. I don't know about the capacity. The biggest limit on our capacity, and there are a number. I mean, when you get into that region, there is no such thing as a cakewalk, to coin a phrase. But the biggest limitation on our ability to influence events in Syria is our reluctance to influence events in Syria. The reality is the president does not have the stomach for a serious engagement in the Middle East, and the American public seems to have no stomach for it. And for that matter, the British public and parliament have no stomach for it. And they were sort of first to line up and be our allies in Iraq. So, yes, I think we did. The debacle of Iraq diminished our national will in a way that could cost us. And in Syria, by the way, you know, one other important difference between Syria and Iraq is at least 6 months, a year, 18 months ago, we had pretty good options that it did not involve putting Americans on the ground. Whether those options are, I think the potential for those options wanes day by day as the situation gets more chaotic. But you know, there was nobody except possibly the enemies of America wants to see American troops in Syria.
So the lesson from Iraq is bluff the U.S. and you can call them. Challenge the U.S. and they will wait, and the situation will deteriorate. And they certainly have no more capacity to shock and awe anyone.
Well, yeah, I think that's probably the message we've been sending. I don't think that's the message that necessarily had to be sent. But yes, I mean, look at this latest use of chemical weapons. You know, Obama's now in a situation where he backed down once after the first allegations of chemical weapons. He said we'd arm the rebels, we raised their expectations, and then we did pretty much nothing. So you could look at this latest, much bigger attack with chemical weapons as Assad calling Obama's bluff.
Well, it's amazing. A legacy that Obama and George W. Bush will share. Bill Keller, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Bill Keller is the former executive editor of The New York Times. He's a current op-ed columnist for The Times. Let's take a moment now and remember someone who had praise for Samuel Beckett, William Butler Yeats, and Eminem. Irish poet Seamus Heaney has died at age 74. A poet at home in the classics and in the working fields of his boyhood, he once described his pen as a tool to dig into the potato mold and the soggy peat of his Northern Ireland home. Heaney's The Cure at Troy is an appropriate sentiment, I think, for this difficult week of thoughts about war and remembrances of history in America. History says don't hope on this side of the grave, but then once in a lifetime the longed-for tidal wave of justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme. So hope for a great sea change on the far side of revenge. Believe that further shore is reachable from here. Believe in miracle and cures and healing wells. This is The Takeaway.